If you're listening to this, there's a good chance you work within the real estate investing industry. There's another good chance that you would like to increase the sales of your products or services.
Well, you're in the right place.
United States Real Estate Investor is a platform you need to place your brand directly in front of your target audience. With our focused, growing audience of real estate investing beginners, enthusiasts, and seasoned professionals, you can continually reach our captivated viewers and listeners with ease. To learn more or to get started today, just visit UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com/advertising. That's UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com/advertising. Get ready to increase your brand awareness and your bottom line. Attract clients with content.
Welcome to This Month in Real Estate Investing. In this episode, we'll be covering a variety of real estate investing news items, including from flip to flop, home flipping takes a dive, marking fastest decline in 15 years, could AI replace real estate agents, and opportunity zone extension likely on hold until 2025. Don't forget, you can join the live conversation with your thoughts and questions on Facebook and YouTube during the show. And all this and more on this episode of This Month in Real Estate Investing. Let's start the show. I'm your host, James Brown, and I show people how to make safe, secure returns using our unique, time-tested hybrid investing model. Go to hybridinvestor.vip to learn more. Add the www if it doesn't pop up for you in your browser. If you're watching live, again, feel free to comment and ask questions. Our guests today are Tomas Garcia, Joey Gumatautau, and Chris Logan. In that order, why don't you guys introduce yourselves, share a little bit about your background and the types of investing you guys focus on.
Absolutely. So hi, everyone. My name is Tomas Garcia. I'm co-founder and CEO of ARX. ARX is an automated underwriting platform built for builders and developers to help them with their site selection and due diligence. I started my career as an investment banker at Goldman Sachs. I went on to get my JD MBA from the University of Chicago. And I got my start in the real estate industry, flipping houses in Jersey City. That's a little bit about my background, my area of passion. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here.
Heck yeah, thanks. Joey.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Yeah, so my name is Joey Gumatautau, co-founder, president, and COO of Mogul.club. So we are a fractionalized real estate investing platform aiming to democratize access into lucrative residential real estate investments. A little bit of background about myself. So I started off my career at Goldman Sachs as well, actually, in the merchant bank, was doing private equity and real estate investing for 4 years, kind of up and down the capital stack, both equity and debt, across a really wide array of product types, but had a specialty in single family rentals. So aggregate strategies, built to rent, and then also multifamily as well.
Cool.
Hey, what's going on, guys? My name is Chris Logan. I've been wholesaling houses for the last 10 years. And what I do is I run an online community and coaching program called Virtual Wholesaling Made Simple. Having done over 600 deals in the past, I show people how to wholesale houses from home anywhere in the country. It doesn't matter if they have a full-time job, no team, no experience, and less than $1,000 a month for marketing.
Fantastic. Thanks for being on here, guys. Let's dive into the news. From Benzinga, from flip to flop, home flipping takes a dive, marking fastest decline in 15 years. What about
you? So I'd like...
Yeah, go for it.
So I want to jump in here. This is my topic. So, you know, one of the things that I feel right now, because the reason that things have been kind of taking a dive is obviously interest rates have been going up. Houses have become more expensive for people to buy. The prices are outpacing wages. And so people are struggling to be able to afford homes, right? They're all waiting for those interest rates to drop back down. But one of the things that I'll share is that I feel that there's always opportunity in no matter what real estate market that you're in, right? So give you an example, we're constantly able to find discounted real estate opportunities that make great investments, whether we're in an up market or in a down market, it does not matter. And really, you know, crisis creates opportunity. So I feel that I feel like if you know where to look, you're going to find great investment deals when it comes to being an investor. But if you're just going about finding opportunity the traditional way, like going through a realtor and buying deals that everybody else can see and has access to, that's when you're going to get into a little bit of trouble because you're going to be paying more for properties and you're going to struggle to get the margins you truly desire. So I feel the best way to get to increase your margins as an investor is to and to battle the market that we're in is going direct to seller. It's what I show my clients how to do, to pick up the phone, call sellers that are facing situations where they need to sell. They don't care about the interest rate. They don't care about, you know, how much houses have gone up to. They just need to sell. They need the cash to get out of whatever situation they're in. And if you know how to do that, and you really understand how to do that, you can find great deals and help a lot of people no matter what type of market that you're in.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chris is exactly right here. You know, in all of my conversations that I'm having with folks, whether they're builders or flippers or institutional investors, there's been a, essentially as supply of on-market housing has dwindled, the focus has grown more and more on how can you identify the best off-market opportunities before your competitors do. So I think that Chris is exactly right. This is where really it's on us as investors to get creative and try to think of how we can identify or how we can build our funnel in a way that you know that is different from maybe how we've historically operated, where we've been looking for deals on the market. In the acquisition space, the majority of the profit, right? The majority of the profit on any good deal is made on the acquisition. So the better that you can get at building your off-market funnel, the better you can get at mitigating your risk and continuing to be profitable in a tough market environment. The other thing that I would say, just quickly to touch on data points, you know, I think one of the we can't overlook the importance of the spike in material costs. As affecting the bottom line for ROI on these flip products, right? So we had supply chain disturbances over the last couple of years. I believe material costs are up 40%, really over the last, you know, from 2020 to 2022. And I think that like a really good data point actually is that we're seeing those material costs stabilize. So historically, you know, those costs have grown at around 3% year over year. We've seen those at flat, really flat to slightly downward over the last 2 years. And so everyone's kind of asking themselves, you know, what's going to be happening to material costs over the next few years. And so that's something as a flipper I would really be keeping my eye on because that's ultimately also going to affect your bottom line profitability on your deals.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more with both Chris and Tomas's analyses. I think real estate generally, especially on the investing side, right, is always split into operations and kind of capital markets, right, back end sales, acquisition, as Tomas pointed out. And so when you're relying on the opportunity to achieve a solid cost basis and rely on a good sale at exit, especially when it comes to home flipping, most of that reliance comes from capital markets, right, from demand and sales. And so as Chris, you know, pointed out, right, with higher interest rates today, there's going to be a lot of challenges, or have been a lot of challenges in the near term past with liquidity, you know, with exits on the back end. We're seeing a lot of, you know, cutting in prices more recently. And as Tomas pointed out, obviously material on the builder side from a GC perspective definitely comes into play, as well as labor costs have been high as well. So that's what I would add.
Quick thing to add, guys, would you guys also agree, like, you know, the big thing about this article, right, it's talking about a reduction in prices since 2022, right? We all know it was happening in 2021, 2022. Mm-hmm. Properties were selling for bananas prices, right? They're saying like $50,000, $100,000 over asking at some points. So it's like, yes, prices coming down a little bit as compared to 2022, but really at the same time, is it really because of the appreciation and the demand was forcing that up so much? So, I mean,
I mean, that's, I think that's a great point. I think that the, you know, the prices have softened since 2022, obviously. And I think that a lot of that is the market is settling out and waiting to see how these, you know, these, everyone has a view on sort of on what's going to be happening with interest rates over the next year. Me personally, I don't see a lot of downward movement or need to, you know, for interest rates to move down over the next year. And so I think that the market right now is just getting comfortable with these. Are these higher rates here to stay? And if so, you know, fundamentally, what one of the sort of the biggest drivers in the real estate market right now is this massive undersupply of housing, right? So we can talk about the supply gap for an entire other, you know, other show and walk through all the data there. But I think that fundamentally is going to anchor, you know, pricing real estate values at residential real estate in particular at a high floor, right? Commercial is an entirely other space. One of the other things we want to look at on the flipping side is also there's, you know, I was reading a recent John Burns research and consulting report that was talking about the supply of homes that make for prime remodeled candidates. Now that supply on an annual basis is typically something around like 20 million homes a year. And they define that as homes between 20 and 39 years of age. Well, guess what? You know, we're sitting here, we're in 2024. So if we think back what was happening 20 years ago, right, we had the housing boom and the lead up to the, you know, to the great crash. So there's actually this forecast that there's going to be actually some very good movement in the supply of homes that would make for good flip candidates. So instead of sort of that 20 million homes a year average, it's expected to rise year over year by about 2 million over the next few years. And so that's something that I think we can also take into account. I think that the flipping market has entered sort of a softer period, but I think that there are, you know, these tremendous signals and data points that show, you know, there is strong, a strong floor for value, and there's an increasing supply of homes that are going to make good candidates for this. So I think this is a great time to be optimistic actually about the future of the remodeling industry.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Great feedback, guys. I don't flip myself. I actually actively avoid it. So I'm glad you guys are on here. Cool. Let's jump into the next article from Benzinga again. Investors paid $65,000 for a deserted Florida island. Now it's a paradise worth $14 million. So just a little summary. So in 2017, a group of four friends bought this island that was known as Beer Can Island because all these people go party and just throw their beer cans on it. And they came in and totally cleaned it up. Made an upscale private club. So
that's classic real estate though. Finding a diamond in the rough, right? Something where one person sees junk and they see a bunch of beer cans piling up on an island. And the other people see like, this is an island, this is opportunity, right? And so they went in, they took a risk. And in real estate, sometimes you take risks like that. I mean, you can get big rewards. And this is just one example of that. I mean, to be able to invest $65,000, clean it up, and then have it listed for $14 million is just totally crazy. But that's just a window inside what is possible with real estate. If you really start to understand it, you get a good handle on it. You can see the opportunity where other people can't. Like, that's where you can make the money.
Yep.
Yeah. Well said, Chris. I think too, like, a lot of that value is probably derived from the infrastructure that went into it, right? I mean, as Tomas is probably an expert on too. The zoning, the permitting, you know, running a business. It sounds like if there's a club on it, alcohol licensing. I mean, all of that went towards building this now like fully functioning social scene. And I imagine that's where a lot of the back end value comes from. And it looks like they're also trying to unlock some of that value via liquidity, right? With like a token offering, which is pretty wild. Just given the fundamentals have to definitely be there from like a cash flow perspective, you know, future growth perspective. So curious to kind of, you know, learn more about how much infrastructure went into that.
Love that.
I think that they invested pretty heavily in it, right? What I'm seeing here is that they spent over $5 million on the, on the actual renovation. So the pop is not as good as $90,000 to $14 million, but that's still a pretty that's still a pretty good pop, right? I mean, I think this is a this is an amazing story, obviously, and I think it really is a testament to having a vision and executing on that vision, right? It shows how a lot of the time as entrepreneurs, as real estate investors, part of the job is the ability to see around corners and see opportunities that other people might honestly probably these four guys, their friends and family. Or these four people, I don't know anything about them, but their friends and family probably said that they were crazy, right? And now they have the last laugh here. And this is also a good reminder that this is what happens when things work out. You get a really, really great news article, and you get us talking about you on a show. But it's also important to think about risk mitigation when you're going into these scenarios. Make sure you do your homework. Make sure you have a strong thesis. Because for every success story that you read, there's also something that you don't know about where it didn't work out.
That's actually a really good point you brought up there, Tomas, because like I'd be really interested to see what these guys' track record is, right? Like if this is their first big project, they're like, let's just go all out, right? Or did they partner with somebody? Have they done projects like this before and had a successful track record? So that would also be interesting to look at to see how this is going to play out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if these guys had some sort of like hospitality background or something like that. Like this reads to me like Soho House on the beach, pretty much.
Exactly.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I love this one. Well, let's jump to the next article from the LA Times. California is building fewer homes. The state could get even more expensive. And they refer to Ken Cahan, I guess that's how you say it, from California Landmark Group. He was developing luxury apartment complexes and also some income-restricted ones as well. What do you guys know about the California market?
So I'm based out of Los Angeles. I just moved here in the last year though, so I'm gonna qualify all my statements with that. I'm still very much learning about the California markets. I look at I look at this through the lens of I think the California markets are good. It's a good microcosm for what's sort of happening in the rest of the country. And the article sort of walks through this too, which is that we're seeing a general softening. There's a lot of uniqueness in California, but we're seeing a general softening in the multifamily market, sort of robust tailwinds for the single family market. I think the article talks about how they've seen sort of a 35% increase in permitting for single family, and they've seen that exact same decrease for multifamily in the state. Obviously, there's a huge amount of tract development going on in the Inland Empire. So if you're thinking about Riverside County, Ventura County, these are some of the, Inland Empire is one of the hottest sort of single family development markets across the country. And where the article, I think, really, focuses in and nails in on one of the things that I see a lot, happening in real estate is a lot, we have this housing supply crunch. There is a temptation to legislate your way out of that crunch. And I think a lot of the time, we have well-intentioned or good-meaning legislation that is passed in an attempt to alleviate, some of the supply crunch and try to encourage, in the case of Measure ULA that passed in Los Angeles, more commonly referred to as the mansion tax, there's an attempt to alleviate housing costs, incentivize the construction of missing middle housing. And oftentimes, that well-intentioned legislation just has, has unintended consequences. So something that I was surprised by, because you always hear about this measure, and for clarity's sake, this is a measure that imposes a tax on the sale of properties over $5 billion, and then it steps up at over a $10 million sale. And you hear this referred to as the mansion tax. When I first heard about this, I thought that this applied only to residential housing. Surprise, this actually applies to all real estate construction in Los Angeles, right? So this is applying to construction of multifamily apartment buildings. This is applying to office construction. This is applying to everything. I believe I'm correct in saying that. That's what the article says. So if I'm wrong, the article's wrong as well. But that's really just a mind blowing intervention in the real estate market, where now you're essentially saying, you know, if you want to build an apartment complex, right, that's probably gonna, you know, if it's of certain size, it's gonna sell for more than $5 million in its totality, right? So now you're throwing on top of that sale at least a 4% tax that's directly hitting the bottom line of the developer. You've just made it immensely harder for for developers to deliver more units to housing in an already difficult environment. So it's a little bit of a I think that, you know, that we could talk about the housing market itself, the implications of the taxes, but what I see here is there's a broader story, which is the importance to actually to really model out, you know, what the economic impacts of legislation are and how they affect developers and investors' incentive structures.
100%. Always got to have that bear case scenario. So my family's actually on the Bay Area. I grew up in the Bay Area. I think a lot of what's happening now with, as Tomas pointed out, with supply shortages, I feel like, you know, with suburbanization, ruralization, people are always, you know, especially more lately coming out of the pandemic and kind of the years following, there was a lot of shift towards moving out of those core kind of infill areas, right, into more suburban, you know, rural areas in like the East Bay, for example, in the Bay Area, or, you know, as Tomas pointed out, you know, Riverside, San Bernardino, Inland Empire from like LA, right? A lot of people are actually commuting into the city from a lot of these kind of suburbanization, ruralization areas. It's interesting because a lot of the things that are happening now, even though there is relative softening with, you know, pricing coming out of the obviously upswing that happened in home prices post-pandemic, there's still a lot of shadow market demand. A lot of places that like San Francisco and LA have all cash buyers that are willing to, come in and swoop up these homes that are still listing for under 30 days on average within the city. And even though there is softening on some prices, a lot of these owners as well have been, you know, sitting on these homes for years. You know, most of them are already paid off from a leverage perspective. You know, their mortgages are paid down. The rates are relatively low, right? I think the average rate was around 4 or 5% for existing loans, as they mentioned in the article. And so I think one of the things that we're going to see is as that demand remains sticky and as kind of, you know, animal spirits around these core areas, you know, like the New Yorks of the world, the San Franciscos, the LAs come back, you know, whether it is with the kind of upstart of the office scene again, or if it is just generally with, you know, ups and downs of these core cities, you know, I'm curious to see what we'll see in the future. And maybe Chris has some good insight into pricing.
Sure. Yeah. So no, that's totally, man. You know, one of the things that we're seeing in, give you an example, Jacksonville, I don't know too much about California. One of the things we're seeing in Jacksonville is there's like almost an overbuild of new construction houses from like local companies and national companies alike. And what's happening now is the new construction houses are actually selling for less than the resale homes, the homes that have been remodeled. And so that's causing the resale homes to sit on the market for a much longer period of time. And I connected with one of my local realtor connections. She's a member on our team in the Jacksonville market. And check out some of the bonuses that a lot of these new construction companies are offering to homeowners to purchase their home over resale. Give an example, 6% closing costs, paid rate lock to 4.375%, and you get to pick the closing date, right? Next one is $48,000 in incentives, only a $10,000 binder, which is usually 5% of the purchase price, so would have been closer to $45,000. $25,000 off lot premium, $15,000 extra incentives on top of the $15,000 already offered. So it's very interesting to see what's happening in just different parts of the country. You know, I feel like you guys touched on earlier, with material costs kind of stabilizing now, those are increasing for a long time. So that caused people to pause for a little bit. So only time will tell to see how things are going to shake out. But It's just really interesting how in certain parts of the country, there's a lot of new construction and it starts competing with even the resale homes. And then other parts of the country, you know, there's just still not enough inventory. So it's just going to be interesting to see how things go over the next several years.
Totally. Let's jump into the next one from Benzinga. If you're in desperate need of an affordable house, Baltimore is selling them for $1. So they've got the buy into BMOR program. These are city owned vacant homes. They're selling them for $1. Of course, there's rules around it. So, and again, these are underprivileged neighborhoods, probably similar to opportunity zones, which we'll talk about as well. So let me just read off some of these contingencies. So they've got to invest $90,000 in renovations, live in the home within a year, and live there for at least 5 years. So that's definitely a specific group that's going to be able to do that, obviously. So you want to jump in on that one?
This is kind of similar to something that HUD did in Florida, where they did $100 homes. Uh-huh. And so very, very similar to that. But again, there was restrictions on there. You'd have to be a nonprofit to be able to buy the property. And there was a lot of other restrictions on there. I don't remember all the others, but I do know that you had to be a nonprofit. They were not open to investors. But, you know, anytime you have a program like this, there is going to be people that are going to be out there that are going to be like, man, if I could get a house for $1, if I get a house for $100, maybe they create different entities and they figure it out, but and they try to work the system a little bit. But I think this could be a great opportunity to revitalize those areas that are a bit rough and to get more improvement going in there, getting those houses that have been sitting vacant, maybe boards on the wall, boards on the windows, remodeled and looking better, just to make that whole, you know, whole area better. So I think programs like this are really great when the local government's willing to do it. So, yeah, only time will tell how this is going to go.
Yeah. I mean, I see that I read this article and I think it's an exciting idea. It's kind of one of those that we're going to have to see how it plays out. I don't think that it's, you know, it just based on the restrictions, it's not really relevant from a flipper or investor perspective, because obviously there are restrictions on this that bar you. What I would be curious to see is, and actually, Chris, I don't know, maybe you have some knowledge. This is the first time hearing about, you know, that HUD program in Florida. How long has that been in? Has that been around, and has that been viewed as a success to your knowledge? I don't know if you know about that.
Yeah, no, I don't know too much about it. I just know that it's been around for a long time. And I remember, like, because when I first got into real estate 10 years ago, HUD homes were a thing, right? Right. Like a lot of investors were flipping HUD homes. And mm-hmm. that was just one of the types of sales that they had. And investors were not allowed to bid on them. You had to have a nonprofit and you had to prove that you had a nonprofit and all that. And so there's a lot of hoops, but it just, that kind of a thing, it creates opportunity for people where maybe they couldn't buy the house outside of that. Or if a nonprofit buys, it allows them to create opportunity for others. But the whole area benefits as a whole, because, you know, when they renovate that property and make it into from an old rundown property, maybe has squatters in it. Now it's a beautiful property and they can just start doing that in multiple houses in the neighborhood. Values come up, the quality of, you know, the right. quality of the demographic there goes up, and it just improves the whole community. So.
No, it seems very promising. One of the things that I would be interested to see how it plays out. The restriction, the requirement that you invest $90,000 to renovate. That's a steep requirement, because you're thinking about it. If you have $90,000 of cash sitting around, I'm just going to use, you know, a 20% down payment. That's getting you theoretically into a $450,000 home. And I think that the article mentioned that the average home price in Baltimore is $257,000. So if you, it's kind of it goes back to this, like, what are the incentives when we're putting in place these legislation? Who are these laws really for? Because I'm curious to see how that $90,000 restriction actually impacts the success of this plan. Maybe there are some financing alternatives, right? Like maybe there's a financing program that we're unaware of that's not discussed in the article, and that would tip it over the edge to say, well, wait a second, you know, if I can finance the majority of that $90,000, now we're talking, versus if I have to have $90,000 in cash, well. That's a different type of program. Sorry, Joey, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Oh, no, not at all. I completely agree. And that's actually something I was going to point out to you, Tomas, is like that $90,000 is really no small chunk of change. And if you're thinking right. about what that looks like on a margin of the home values there now, like that $250,000 range, like I'd be really curious to see how that translates into value increases market-wide, right? Because that takes time. And we've seen case studies with different revitalization efforts in several cities, like, you know, Chris cited. And then also, you know, there were some in Dallas. There have been several around Southern California. There was one in Houston. They all took years before, you know, you could actually see some tangible upswings in like what those prices look like. So it really all comes down to the incentives, but full support of like the free market revitalization efforts. I think it's an incredible opportunity, but yeah, very curious to see how that will play out.
Fantastic. Hey, let's just take a break and hear from our first sponsor.
Join renowned note investor and host Nathan Turner at the 9th Annual Diversified Mortgage Expo in the heart of Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. This May 31st through June 1st, experience the world of note investing at the DME Note Investing Conference. Across two action-packed days, engage in 18 informative sessions covering everything from first and second lien mortgages to seller financed paper and institutional loans. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, the DME 2024 is your gateway to learning from industry leaders. Hosted by DME organizer Nathan Turner at the Hilton Nashville Airport Hotel, enjoy a venue that's perfectly tailored for learning and networking, with quiet seating areas ideal for one-on-one meetings. And outside the conference space, feel free to explore Nashville's rich heritage and vibrant culture. Don't miss out on the opportunity to network with hundreds of investors, institutional sellers, industry experts, and high-quality service providers. Grow your knowledge, expand your network, and elevate your business. Act fast by April 30th to take advantage of early bird ticket pricing. It's not just a conference, it's where the note industry meets to learn, network, and grow. To get your tickets now, visit UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com/DME2024. That's UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com/DME2024. The Diversified Mortgage Expo. Learn, network, grow. See you in Nashville.
All right. Yeah, Nathan Turner, who's putting that on, he's been a guest on our show a couple times. He knows what he's talking about. So if you're, especially with the note investing.
Very cool.
All right, let's get back to the news from Las Vegas Review Journal. Could AI replace real estate agents? So I'm a licensed agent. Are either of any of you guys licensed agents? And what do you think? Oh, you are, Chris?
Oh, you're on mute, Chris.
Oh, yeah, you're muted.
There we go. I feel that AI is going to be more so a tool that is going to help realtors become more efficient and be able to serve their clients better. I feel the agents that are in fear of AI replacing them as a direct contact with sellers and buyers, and it's going to take them out of the picture is just, that's totally crazy. That would never happen. The ones that use AI and say, I'm going to use this as a tool to make doing business with my clients better and help them, you know, service them better are the ones that are going to thrive. The ones that are just kind of stuck and worrying for their jobs, they're going to fall by the wayside anyway. So that's really what I feel. The person that is beta testing this, they're a broker. So they're not looking to replace their own job, you know, and again, AI still has to be told what to do in a lot of ways. So if you can tell it what to do and you know how to do it, you know how to work with it, you're really going to thrive in this new economy that we're going into. Because again, you know, setting up manual property searches and handling conversations that's like really quick conversations that are very, very basic, it's going to save the agent time, allow them to service more clients. And like I said, get answers faster to their clients they have anyway. So I think AI is going to be a huge plus for realtors and all businesses.
It'll be a great supplemental tool. And honestly, for education too, right? Like I went through the home buying process for the first time about 4 years ago. And honestly, I had no idea what I was doing, right? I had this background in real estate, study economics, and had essentially no practical knowledge of the home buying process. So I think that the education that'll come with that, right, of having like a chat tool, for example, that can just kind of give you all the know-how answers of like what to do when navigating through a transaction is going to be incredible. However, as Chris said, and definitely would echo, I think no two transactions are the same, right? And AI is all about pattern recognition. So, you know, training something to automate the buying process, I mean, I don't think it'll ever truly be done to a point where it can be fully automated. There's always going to have to be someone navigating kind of the twists and turns of every real estate transaction. And I think Chris was spot on with his analysis.
Yeah, thanks, Joey. I mean, AI is a tool, and the people who learn how to use it are going to thrive, and the people that don't want to learn how to use it, and the people are kind of stuck in their own ways, and they're just worried it's going to replace their job. Like I said, I don't think they're going to be around long anyway. So,
yeah, I use it to do property descriptions.
Yeah, yes. That's huge. Huge.
You got this long list, and you got to make it flow, and it just helps smooth it out. And I still have to go in there and tweak it. There's still a human part of it. But man, that really helps. And there's so many other things. In fact, Rick Jansen, he's with EXP, our brokerage, and spoke on stage with me at our regional rally recently. He's got a couple different tools. One of them, he calls it your virtual twin. So you've probably seen it, you know, where they do the deep fake thing. So you record a video of yourself. So it's got your face, and then
that's freaky.
You plug in, have it with scripts, and you know, use that for content to generate leads. It's amazing. But it's not going to replace. I think the biggest thing is the emotions, helping people get through that part. Mm-hmm. AI is not going to be able to replace that part of us.
Real estate is very much a people business, very much a people business. And you'll never take the people out of it.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah. And then that pivots into negotiation, which is very emotional and complex. I just don't see how AI, even with two AI bots battling it out in negotiation, how it ever end up, you know, working out, you know, both sides or one side. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, we work obviously in automation for site selection and due diligence. So we work less so with agents, much more so with the home building community. And I think regardless of what industry you're in, whether you're a lawyer, you're an investment banker. I mean, there's been news articles, right, about how they're simply going to replace analysts at investment banks, right? And I think that what it comes back to time and time again, and I think, you know, Chris hit on this spot off, that it's with regards to this title, it's not that, you know, AI is going to replace real estate agents. It's that real estate agents with AI are going to replace real estate agents. So that is kind of the standard across whatever industry you're with. If you're a lawyer and you're leveraging AI, you are simply going to be more efficient than a lawyer who is not leveraging AI. Same thing for a real estate agent, same thing for an acquisitions team member. It's just too much of a competitive advantage. You always need to step in for those final tweaks, like what you were describing, but it can get you 80 to 90% of the way there. And it can get you there in a fraction of the time that it would otherwise take you if you were just going through your manual process. And it's that 80 to 90% time savings that's just massive when it compounds deal over deal over deal. So I think that's really the takeaway, which is that, you know, people are scared of AI, but really it behooves us all to learn sort of what are the, you know, what's within the realm of the possible. What are the limitations, right? You're not just going to post a property description that an AI spits out after looking at the photos. You're going to read through it and you're going to make the adjustments that you see are right, because that's what's needed to be done. But it's a massive force multiplier. So it's on all of us to really educate ourselves and learn how we can integrate it into our businesses.
100%. Yeah, you know, somebody that spoke on stage at our regional rally was talking about the days of the Vanna White realtor, you know, she's all dressed up and, oh, here's the kitchen, you know, like if that's all they've got to offer, that's going away. You know, people can see photos and videos and go, you know, we'll figure out how to get people into homes where they don't have to open a door that's still going to be a thing. But anyway, you know, it's people that bring that true value that can help negotiate, deal with contracts and all the nitty gritty stuff. They're the ones that are going to survive, really. And AI is just going to help most people really dominate.
Definitely.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Totally agree.
Yep. Bye-bye, Vanna White. Is she even alive still? I don't know. Sorry, Vanna.
Why don't you come out in a little square? Hey, guys.
Yeah, she's watching now.
Vanna's watching you.
All right, let's go to our next one from Wealth Management. Opportunity zone extension likely on hold until 2025. Does anybody want to define what an opportunity zone is and dive into if you guys know anything about them or have used them?
I know I'm intro light, so I'm gonna defer if there's an expert here.
Yeah.
I would say
I know what it is, but it's not my wheelhouse. Exactly. I just know it's an area where you get tax breaks for investing in areas like that. And it's usually like lower income areas, I believe.
Yep.
That's all I know.
So they're trying to revitalize an area, so they give those tax breaks.
It's deferment on capital gains tax, depending on how long you're holding the actual property. The zones themselves were designated by Congress in 2017, if that's right.
Yeah.
And the article at Hold is talking about how, or at Bear is talking about how those tax benefits, I believe, are currently set to expire, and there's legislation to increase the duration of that hold period to allow people to continue to benefit from these zones. Of course, we find ourselves in an election year, and despite the bill having broad bipartisan support, it's probably not something we're going to see happening this year, just due to it being an election year.
I
think there's a broader story here in terms of the opportunity zones themselves. I think it goes back to sort of, you know, from our areas of expertise, maybe the discussion point is when we're talking about interest rates, when we're talking about policy and legislative changes and how that might impact investor activity. The election years like this are years of uncertainty. So we see a lot of corporations taking a step back. We see a lot of pause on activity as people wait to see what things are going to look like once the dust settles. And so it's a good time for everyone to be sort of digging in on their research and getting prepared for market movement, you know, once that dust settles.
So we have the definition here. Opportunity zones are economically disadvantaged census tracts across the U.S. in which investors can gain tax benefits by investing in eligible properties and businesses. Right now, there are 8,700 qualified opportunity zones across the country. So quite a few. Mm-hmm. All across the country. I know I've looked at different ones here in the Denver area, and where I used to live was part of that. Mm-hmm. For good reason. It was, and there's a reason I moved out of that area. It was not changing fast enough. All right, let's go to the next. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, James. I was just going to say that ties into what we were talking about in Baltimore, for example, right? A lot of these economic incentives to revitalize, opportunity zones is just another form of that. Didn't have a chance to work on one directly, but I know we did. We underwrote a couple opportunities while we were at Goldman. And from what I could understand, it was usually on like a 5-year minimum term, I think, was like the eligibility requirement. And one of the like criticisms that was often brought up is that the access into these like opportunity zone funds was very much kind of reserved for like the ultra wealthy, right? Like the top 1% of the 1% of institutions, high net worth individuals. And so there's a lot of ancillary benefits that come along with those revitalization efforts, right? And as you were saying, James, like they're not immediately apparent, which is part of the issue, because a lot of those tax benefits are immediately apparent for those investing. And so there's just a really interesting trade-off with kind of how those work. I'm not an expert on the mechanics by any means. But yeah, anyone has any other thoughts on that?
Let's see. Let's jump into the next one. Oh, did somebody have something? Okay. NBC6 South Florida News. A new real estate trend: shopping malls converted into residential units in South Florida. Of course, this comes up every month recently. So,
I think this is a really good thing. You know, it's going to be sad to see shopping malls go away. I mean, when I was a kid, going to the mall, and that was just a thing you did, right? And eventually, you know, I feel shopping malls are all going to go away, but I feel turning them into like mixed use is a really good thing, where you have, like, you know, condos there, you have restaurants, you have a space that you can go and hang out. We're seeing a lot of these transitions here in Tampa, where I live, right? There's a Westfield Mall in Tampa that they're basically tearing it down, and they're turning it into like this mixed use area. And it's just going to be a nice place to go to, where you're going to have restaurants there, you're going to have people who can live there. And I feel like it's going to offer a different type of living for people, and different types of entertainment, you know. And I think it's just really going to revitalize areas, and going to be much better than having a mall that's like half empty, or they put all these random stores into that people are like, why is that even in there? And instead, it's going to have a place where you can bring people together and just have a different experience. So I think it's a really positive thing than having a big empty building just sitting there, because there's not much you can do with that, you know?
Yep.
Definitely. Yeah. Tomas touched on it earlier. It's like most of these malls are in prime, like, infill locations. So taking advantage of that locational benefit and, you know, converting them into housing, right? Because housing is never going away. E-commerce is taking over, right? In-person retail shopping is very much dying, in my opinion. Certain aspects of it, at least, and you know, housing is never going away. So
totally agree with that. 100%.
And I think that this is a trend that it's not just, you know, the article discusses, you know, like a large scale development, right? Like 5,000 units or something, you know, massive project. But I think more and more what we're seeing is, you know, from a construction side, where a lot of builders are looking for good infill opportunities, right? Where it's not necessarily a massive project. It's, you know, where is there, you know, struggling retail or struggling commercial assets that, you know, we could reposition into, call it 30 to 150 homes, right? That's becoming more and more popular as time goes on. I was just at the ULI meeting a couple of weeks ago, and that was one of the, you know, main topics of discussion there, which is that folks really see their, you know, there's a lack of good development opportunities. Folks are looking for land that is well positioned, and so I think we're going to see a boom in this area of infill, you know, infill conversions from commercial assets into residential, either single family homes or townhomes, over the next, you know, 6-10 years. This is where the market is heading.
Yep. Article mentioned a 37% shortfall in Miami's housing inventory.
Yeah.
That's significant.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah. I was going to say, if as investors, if we can come up with solutions.
Right. No, I mean, that's Miami in particular, you know, that you see this in a lot of coastal cities as well. You know, there's just a lack of buildable land, right? Miami is landlocked. It's got the Everglades, it's got the ocean. There are only so many places that you can build houses. And when you have a top tier city like that, where folks want to live there, they want to move there. To Joey's point, you know, housing's always going to be in demand to some respect or another. So it becomes a question of, well, where can we actually build? And I think it's very, very sexy. You see this in the media a lot, where people are talking about, how do we convert office buildings into multifamily residential floor plates? I mean, I think that that's a great conversation to have. I think that that is, it's very sexy. I think there is a good, you know, there is a good business there, but I think that the impact of those conversions is substantially smaller. We were talking a little bit about this earlier. It's substantially smaller than you could actually, the impact that could be created through these types of infill opportunities. And so this is really an area that I think you're gonna see the market continue to focus on, where commercial assets are repositioned in their entirety into these mixed use developments or fully residential communities.
Yeah. Any other comments? Okay. From the New York Times, a huge number of homeowners have mortgage rates too good to give up, as we're all well aware. Oh boy. They're calling it the locked in effect.
I think people who need to sell are going to sell regardless, right? Life happens. People get relocated for jobs. People need money. Life events happen. I feel like the people that need to sell are going to sell. The people that don't, that want to upgrade and want to buy a new home, if the rates price them out of where they want to be, they're going to hold on to their homes for a little bit longer. But at least for what I do with the off-market investment side, the distressed real estate side, interest rates are not really going to impact people too much if you're focusing on the right demographic. So right now, for example, we're seeing is we're, there's 10,000 baby boomers every single day that are retiring, right? Every single day. And a lot of them are selling to downsize, selling to move in with their kids or their other members of their family. And that group of people, they could care less about the interest rate. They care less about appreciation and all that. All they want to do is get, downsize something a little bit easier and save a bit of money. So that group of people, also landlords, people that have owned properties for 15, 20 years, maybe they have an amazing rate, right? They could care less about the rate. So what we're doing right now is we're doing a lot of our marketing towards them and then senior owners too, because again, they're just people that are primed to sell right now. But people that, got 2% or 3% interest rates during COVID and they're kind of hanging tight to sell, you may have a lot of people holding back, but there's a lot of people who bought houses on impulse, right? Where they bought a house and they're like, because it was the frenzy where they had 10 people and they had to be the highest bid and get it, and they got it. And then they're like, shoot, I really don't like this house. I sacrificed on a lot of things. So I think if people really want to move, they're going to move, right? Because at the end of the day, interest rate is not permanent, right? It's always something they could refinance out of into something else. Interest rates have gone up and down over the years. Time will only tell if it gets as low as it did before. But I mean, at the end of the day, I feel like the people that want to sell, like if there's realtors right now that are like, oh, my business is suffering because I don't have enough clients to work with or this, that, and the other, they just have to adapt to the market we're in right now. And the move they need to make right now is focusing on the people that want to sell, focus on the people that they can help, and just everybody else will fall in line.
Yeah.
That is so spot on. That is so spot on. I think people always forget that the current interest rates are temporary, right? And you can refinance at some point. Ideally, you want to amortize that upfront cost of, taking out that leverage and your origination fees, et cetera, closing costs over a longer period of time. But that's so true. It's all temporary. And if someone's sitting on a low rate right now, that means two things. That means they have likely substantial equity in their property, right? If it's a lower rate from a friendlier credit borrower environment in the past. And then two, obviously that cheap cost of capital on the mortgage side. And the traditional means of liquidity for a homeowner, right, for a seller is you could either, sell or essentially refi, right, in the form of a home equity line of credit, second mortgage, et cetera. There's 100 different ways to do it. But there's like a weird adversarial effect, because the cost of capital to take out a HELOC, right, on especially like a shorter term rate, which is probably north of, the prime rate, right? North of 10% plus, whatever, or the prime rate's like 8.25% or something. So then the rate for a HELOC is probably 10% plus, I think, right now. Taking out that expensive leverage against your equity makes zero sense, right? But people are also obsessed with holding on to their low rate on their primary mortgage. And it's like, well, what's the answer? What do you do? We're working on ways right now to, I'm sure just as Chris is describing, to increase liquidity for very low cost to sellers directly, which I know a lot of people are finding ways to do that via, permissive transfer agreements, right, for their loans to be transferred to others outside of your typical FHA transfer. Trusts, right, is another way to do it. Just curious to see, what's going to happen. I think there's going to be a buyer frenzy in the near term. As Tomas pointed out earlier, definitely a lot of great kind of fundamentals coming into light for single family development and rentals going forward. And I think, you know, time will tell kind of what happens on the liquidity side.
Good points, Joey. Good points.
Thanks.
Yep. And
it's,
you know,
well spoken. It's great.
Well, one of the other things I like to touch on here too is this kind of has a theme with the other article we talked about with AI and real estate and people worrying if their jobs are going to be replaced, like realtors saying, is this robot going to replace me? This virtual robot, is he going to replace me and serve, I serve my clients, right? And then you have realtors right now that are like, oh, nobody wants to move. You know, it's just, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I can't be a realtor anymore. It's so tough right now, but got to adapt, right? This is the time right now in real estate where you got to become creative. You got to adapt, and you can't focus on all the reasons why you can't do something. You have to focus on the reasons why you can, and you got to look for opportunity where other people don't see it, because I think that is really going to really define who succeeds in this market, who doesn't, or the people that adapt and the people that find a way to succeed, right? And find clients to serve versus the people that just are like a tree. They're just stuck and they're like, there's nothing I can do. You know, I just don't know what to do, and so on. So I really feel like, again, the people that are creative right now and the people that are the ones that says, I will find a way and I'm going to adapt, are the ones going to thrive. And the ones that just say, oh, it's poor me, this, that, and the other, they're victim in this market. They're the ones that are going to be replaced, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I just released a book on divorce, people going through divorce all the time. Right. And it's, gets complicated. So I released a book to help people kind of navigate that. So
love that.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Like navigating how to get divorced or navigating the. Not to plug the book, but can we?
Yeah. First chapter is just a good nudge. Like, why would you get married?
That's so good.
Oh, man. Oh, good stuff.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's take a break for our next sponsor.
Are you looking to elevate your business through exceptional content? Universe Media Publishing is your gateway to success. We understand that in the world of business, content is king, but not just any content. Your business deserves content that captivates, convinces, and converts your audience into clients. At Universe Media Publishing, we specialize in crafting SEO-rich web content, persuasive copywriting, and marketing copy that resonates with your audience. We don't just write, we engage, we connect, and we deliver results. Imagine your brand's voice amplified, your message crystal clear, and your presence dominating the digital landscape. That's the power of partnering with Universe Media Publishing. Don't let your business just blend in. Stand out, be heard, and make an impact. Connect with us at Universe Media Publishing, and let's turn your vision into reality. Visit universemediapublishing.com today. Your story, our expertise, together we'll create magic.
Okay, back to the show. From Portland Press Herald, Biddeford, if that's how you say it, landlord claims Central Maine Power Company double billed her and tenants for nearly 20 years.
Wow.
That added up a little bit.
Just a little.
She said she's estimating losses between $50,000 and $125,000. And they actually admitted to it, but not all of it, sounded like. So she's trying to go back 20 years.
I wonder how she caught it and why she didn't catch it sooner. I mean, 20 right. years, that's a that's a long time. It's like, oh, by the way, I just noticed this.
It's kind of on her a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, after not catching it.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I can understand, like, you know, there's a mistake made and then someone comes back and says, hey, you know, I was overcharged here, right? I'd like a credit on my bill. But when you wait 20 years, I mean, it's got to be a statute of limitations or something on that, unless it was just completely hidden from you and you, like, you couldn't see it at all. And then at that point, then that's a different story. But
yeah,
I mean, there is a statute of limitations, and that's why they're admitting to the wrongdoing, but they're saying that they only have to pay for the last 6 years of overbilling instead of 20 years of overbilling. Which is
their own rule, probably.
It's I mean, this is a weird one. That's just like, that's how I feel about it. It's kind of, I mean, like on the one hand, I agree with you, Chris, which is like, you know, this would be something that should show up if you're, you know, maybe this is the importance of proper documentation of your operating expenses when you're owning a building. Like that's the lesson,
yeah.
Right? Because I think she noticed it when she, there was like a revising of some bill or something like that. And that's when it came to her attention. On the other hand, I also don't feel comfortable just saying like, hey, we all get utility bills, right, on a monthly
basis.
And like, probably we all look at it and are like, yeah, that's in line with what it should be on a seasonal basis. But like, I don't know, my utility could be overcharging me by $50 or $25 a month. And
probably wouldn't even notice it.
I wouldn't know if it was like $25 or $50 a month. And that, like, on the other hand, like, that shouldn't be allowed, right? Like, we should have protections as consumers against that. So this is a really, it's a really weird story. It's a really interesting article. I'm curious where the courts are going to come out on the statute of limitations and whether or not it does actually apply in this case, because it's just it's a strange one where somebody has admitted wrongdoing and they're like, yep, we overcharge you for 20 years, but we only owe you for 6. So I don't know. Sometimes you kind of want the courts to send a message, which is like, okay, in this case, we're going to charge you for the 20 years to make sure that you don't do this again to people in the future. That's more of an activist court approach, but this will be an interesting one.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I actually saw a news story on like CNN the other day of a similar issue happening with another couple that was living out in Southern California. And I like, it just got me wondering after reading this too, how many people are truly going through that, right? Because just like Tomas said, like I certainly do not double check my utility bill. Like it's like, okay, it's paid. If anything, it's automatically deducted, right? From auto bill, auto pay, whatever it is. And then you don't go back and be like, okay, wait, this is exactly how much I use. I also remember reading that elsewhere that there are like a lot of issues sometimes with meters, which is super interesting because they're typically not serviced on a regular basis until homes are transacted, right? So until like ownership changes and you need to start and stop services. I know a lot of the servicing on like meters goes by the wayside. So I'm really wondering how much kind of like, you know, delta, right, is truly happening between real usage and what you're billed for. I'm super curious.
Let's jump into the next one from Newsweek. California condo sells for about half its value.
Oof.
The housing market rocked.
Painful.
Yeah. The two-bedroom condo recently sold for $675,000, nearly half its 2019 value of $1.25 million.
Hmm.
That is significant. Wow. I didn't realize.
Condos are the first things that are going to be affected when the housing market starts to turn, you know? Like, yeah. It's one of the first things that start to go and signal everything else.
Right. I mean, my take on this, I think this is a fairly sensational article title. I think this is one of the, like when we're talking about data science, when we're talking about, you know, the data in general, I think it's very, very, we always very big statistics. And I think this is a great example of somebody going and cherry picking a statistic. They found one property, that property, you know, sold for half its value. And it makes for a great, great news article, right? Because now we're here, we're talking about it. But I think that the really what's important, you know, is as analytical people or people who are interested in the real estate market, who want to participate in the real estate market, invest, I think it's really important to not make your decisions based on anecdotes and not make your decisions based off of one-off data points. This is one of those things where it's really important to look at market aggregates. It's really important to look at trends. It's really important to be skeptical, really, of any data set that you're, any data source that you're reading about, right? Whether it's from, whether it's from reports like this or whether it's certain economic indicators that are reported, it's really important to dig into, you know, what is the origination? What is the source of that data? What is the data being used to say? What's the story that's being told with that data? And do you think that there are any flaws, right? Or is there any misrepresentation? Is the data being used in a certain way to perhaps influence your opinion? And so in this case, you know, I think that this is a great example of a single data point, a single anecdote that is being blown up to write a story. And I think there is some merit to that story, right? And there's something there that is worth investigating. But I think that we as analytical people should always be focused on, you know, data in its aggregate versus one-off single points.
You just highlighted why this show is so valuable, because we pull all these headlines and there's a lot of sensational, like, mm-hmm. things like that, where, man, maybe the reality is off from right. that.
Fear sells.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, exactly. That's why I love this show. We can really dig into it as real investors in the trenches.
Right. Absolutely.
Yep. 100%.
Yeah. Our next article from United States Real Estate Investor. New doom loop. St. Louis, Missouri downtown decline drags on. Says there's a record 2.3% downtown office vacancy rate, reminiscent of broader challenges affecting cities like Baltimore and Detroit.
This goes back to adapting, right? A lot of these companies that were downtown, like they have vacant office buildings, a lot of people are working remote, right? Mm-hmm. And so what are they going to do with that office building? Like, how can they, that property owner, like, how can he adapt? Can he turn it into a co-working space, right? Can he turn it into, I don't know, could he turn it into apartments? Or could, like, people just have to adapt right now. This is one of those things where you can say, okay, this is frustrating, this is how it is, but what are we going to do about it? How can we take steps to recover and get out of this situation we're in? Because I feel like more and more companies are going to go virtual, right? Like, think about real estate. Real estate, it wasn't even really too popular about being virtual before COVID, right? Mm-hmm. Typically, from a real estate investor point of view, real estate investors would always meet homeowners at property, shake their hands, and sign a contract in person with the homeowner, right? And homeowners would be really like hesitant to sign contracts over the phone or do business over the phone, right? But with COVID that happened, and then you had Opendoor, OfferPad, all these, you know, tech real estate companies coming into the market, doing business virtually and making offers over the phone, it became more acceptable. And now, even in real estate, which is something that's taken a long time to transition to with technology, they're looking at more of like, okay, now you have virtual brokerages, right? So I feel this trend of people that are not going to be going into a physical office building is going to continue. Sure, there's some talks where it's like, are people as productive at home as they are in an office building and so on? But I feel like the costs are not going to be, like, companies can't justify the cost to have a building now with running that building, mm-hmm. and having a ton of people in the building. I feel like you're going to see, if there are office buildings that are headquarters, they're going to be smaller, and half the time it's going to be vacant, half the time it's going to be full. So only time will tell, but they got to do something else with these buildings than just leaving them vacant.
That's so true. Yeah. From a macro trends perspective, I think something that's also influencing the market is like a lot of the debt that was taken out on these properties, matures, right? There's timelines, there's mm-hmm. extensions, there's opportunities to renegotiate, refinance. And typically with a lot of these, larger lenders that have, loans that are secured by very prominent institutions, there's a lot of leeway in terms of what you can do to structure, facilitate and operate, buildings like the one that was cited in here, the old AT&T building as well. And so I think, I think from a macro trend perspective, Chris spot on, there's definitely a lot of a huge downturn in the operational value when it comes to yields that you can achieve with any commercial building that was, on a typical lease structure with corporate lessors. And so I think one of the things that also, Tomas said that rings true is this is like one data point. There were a lot of extenuating circumstances that went into the purchase. Of specifically the building cited in the article. And so I think definitely important to, expand your view of the market as a whole and not just focus on one data point.
Great points.
And Tony, our producer, said he's from St. Louis. He said he knows of bunch of buildings that have been vacant for 10 plus years. And then COVID and high crime have exacerbated the decline.
One of the things it says in the article here is that cities like San Francisco have begun addressing these issues by converting the office spaces into more attractive and multifunctional areas. So that's like we've been talking about, right? Just adapting, and they've been, you know, taking steps towards that, where other places have just been sitting and just letting the buildings stay vacant.
Right. And I think that it's, you're going to see more and more cities following the lead of San Francisco, more and more savvy owners. Because, you know, if we're talking about macro trends, Joey, like the, I think it's the U.S. share of working from home. Pre-pandemic, it was roughly 6% of all days worked in the United States were work from home. And now, post-pandemic, that trend has settled out over the last few years to about 30%. So you have this massive shift in just how the labor market operates. You have Joey, I'd be curious if your startup is remote or not. You know, Arx is fully remote, right? We don't see the need for office space. We do all of our meetings virtually. We do everything like this. And this is just kind of, it's almost necessary to have that remote option in order to attract top talent as a startup. It's just become sort of table stakes. So I think that it's an interesting, you know, it's obviously a massive shift in how we work as a society. It has implications for both commercial assets, but also, you know, flipping back to sort of the investing side and residential assets, you're seeing a lot of thought going into this fact that, well, wait a second, you know, if I'm designing a new home or if I'm remodeling a home, I need to make sure that, you know, as I'm thinking about what type of product I'm going to deliver to market, you know, 30% of Americans are now working from home. And so the demand or the need for good office space, for example, a home office, has skyrocketed, and you're seeing more and more sort of ahead of the curve builders now starting to start
100%
plans and deliver plans to market that meet those changing or evolving demographic needs. It's something that is certainly going to continue as we move forward here.
Spot on. So spot on.
Yep. Yeah, the overhead you can have from an office, you can be just reinvested back into the business and the growth, marketing, right, infrastructure.
Exactly. Not having rent as a line item on my pro forma is spectacular. Like, it's, exactly. Like when you're doing budgeting, like it's remarkable.
But that's interesting, like you said, Tomas, about influencing building trends, right? Mm-hmm. Like you see a lot of different trends. Like every 10 years, you see different trends in building, and this is an interesting one. Like the expanded home office, or more residential properties are having a home office where they haven't had that before, or maybe haven't had those in a long time. So it's just interesting how local trends, trends in the economy, impact even how we live.
Yeah, absolutely,
definitely.
All right, let's jump into our fun and final news item from Inc. Star psychologist Adam Grant suggests your overall happiness comes down to one life-changing word. And he's talking about generosity, basically. He also talks about getting a helper's high, which activates the brain's reward centers.
I feel that's so true. Like the more that you give, the more you position yourself to receive. And giving without a mindset of, oh, I want something in return, but just like authentic giving, like helping somebody, donating something, tithing to your church, like giving without the expectation of getting something back, just the feeling that you get from doing that, even helping someone who can't help themselves. Like there's a saying that says, you've made a real, like, I think it was like, you know, you haven't really lived until you've done something for someone else that they can never repay you for, right? Mm-hmm. So I had to think about that for a second. But the point is it's about, you know, making a positive impact in the world and looking out for more than just yourself. I feel like we're in a very distracted economy right now where people are too busy to do everything. But really, when you take time to slow down and you focus on what you can do for others, or, you know, tithing, or, you know, giving to a cause you're passionate about, it really does make you feel better And as a result, I feel that you're going to be blessed, you know, accordingly. So
that is so well said. Yeah, I think we're at a time right now where the wealth gap has never been higher, right? It's never been as much of a delta. I think, you know, real estate especially is just such a great way to democratize access, right? Increase opportunity for investors, whether you're automating the underwriting process, increasing zoning transparency, whether you're offering wholesale services directly to buyers, sellers, you know, whether you're democratizing real estate investing in single family rentals, whether you're providing educational services through podcasting, through media. I think it's super important to be able to contribute. And, you know, we're all here, everyone on the show and most people listening, I assume, are, you know, striving to create value, right? They're creating value for themselves. They're creating value for the economy. And then hopefully they're creating value for others in the process. And I think real estate is just such a great private market asset to be able to do that with. You know, there's not a lot of crazy speculation when it comes to, you know, asset level specifics, like, you know, like there is in the public markets. There's a lot of control. You know, you can make educated decisions about what exactly you're going to do. You can do the diligence, you can do the underwriting, just as Tomas pointed out earlier. I think it's just such a great tool to allow people to, you know, increase their overall access and ability to kind of achieve gain.
Preach. Preach. Awesome. Absolutely. Have you guys read The Go-Giver?
Yeah. Got it right.
Oh, without
that is unreal. That is unreal.
You guys prep this or
yeah?
He's like that book right there. Yeah, I recommend this to all my coaching clients because I mean, coming into real estate for the first time, you know, you don't have a lot of like resources, right? And so you have to be about what can I do for you, right? You can't just approach people with this attitude of hey, what are you going to do for me? What are you going to do for me? But you approach this seasoned investors been buying, who buys like 300 deals a year. You haven't even done your first deal, going to him and saying, hey, what's your biggest need right now? How can I help you? Right. Like such a different mentality from saying, hey, you know, do you want to buy my next house? Right. It's just, it's different. And I found that when I first got started, that was really something that really set me apart from a lot of people. I like to think is because like I'd have rehabbers come up to me and be like, hey, Chris, you know, my biggest need right now is I need a new granite guy or I need a new flooring guy, right? And I'd be like, you know what? Let me dig into my Rolodex to see what I can find. I would network like crazy with some of the top investors in the area and I'd get their recommendations and then I'd refer them to him. And he'd be like, are you serious? Wow, it's amazing. Nobody does this, right? And so when you go above and beyond like that for people and you focus on serving first and giving first, right? Like tremendous opportunity comes your way. So couldn't agree more.
Yep. That's how I started going to RIA events. I had nothing to share. And, you know, you get up in front of people and say what you do. I'm like, I don't do anything yet, you know, but
I will be doing something just not yet.
Yeah. Just started building that Rolodex. And now that's really valuable, at least for me and for everybody else. So, and I also have to remind myself to be that go giver and start asking questions. What do you need? That's easy too, right? Instead of forcing it and being like, hey, this is what I need. What do you need? That starts opening up these conversations. Yeah, makes you feel good.
Definitely. Oh, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Definitely.
Yeah. The helper's high. Yeah.
The helper's high. Yeah. I like touching on it just from the, like from a startup or business perspective, right? A lot of people always, a lot of people think that they should start a business because they're motivated by profit or they're motivated by making money. And those are the people who go out of business the fastest. Because you have to have a reason to get up in the morning, right? You have to have a reason to work as hard as, you know, everyone here is working. And a lot of that passion can come from a desire to create social change or social impact. And totally. So I think, you know, like what a lot of us are talking about here is how real estate is a terrific medium to create social impact in addition to, you know, creating financial independency and you know, all of that good stuff as well. It's a unique industry in that respect. And so I think that it's something that is in short supply, and everyone who's participating from the, you know, real estate investors to the flippers, to the developers, to the agents, like all of us are ultimately working towards getting people into houses. Like that's what it ultimately translates to, is getting people housed. And so I think that that's a, you know, it's the reason why I get up every day, is because I want to see a world where, you know, everyone who, you know, everyone who wants to be in housing can be in housing. And I think that that's something that is sort of just the bottom line that underlines every single real estate transaction. So, you know, it's a little bit less from the day-to-day sort of idea of giving, but I think that having that social mission, can be very, very empowering, as entrepreneurs, as business owners, as real estate folks.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this,
that's
this,
good stuff.
Our platform, the United States Real Estate Investor, we've got multiple shows. This is one of them, kind of flagship one. We came up with this to share knowledge on real estate investing, financial literacy. So hopefully we are delivering on that goal.
I love the wide range of topics and just how different each one is and how each person has a unique viewpoint on it and perspective. It really makes you think about these in a lot of different, in different ways than if you had just, you know, read the article yourself and be like, oh, okay, that's good info. Right. But you know, you got some rock stars here on the podcast, and it's been great hearing you guys' perspectives. You guys, like, amazing perspectives on what you've shared, and I've enjoyed hearing your opinions, and it's made me rethink some things too. So
likewise.
Awesome.
Sweet. Well, that covers the news portion of the show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Nathan Turner's Diversified Mortgage Expo 2024 and Universe Media Publishing. And of course, thanks to you guys, Tomas Garcia, Joey Gumatautau, Chris Logan. Appreciate you guys sharing your knowledge and your time. Why don't you, in that order, Tomas, Joey, and Chris, let people know how they can connect with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me, email is probably the easiest way to get in touch with me. It's Tomas, T-O-M-A-S, at arx.city. You can also find me on LinkedIn, or if you just go to the website arx.city, you'll see a contact us form there. So, you know, if anyone's involved in sort of the home building, residential development industry, you know, that's my bread and butter. But would love to connect with any listeners regardless. Thank you very much for having me on the show today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Very nice. Yeah, you can reach me by email as well. J-O-E-Y, Joey at mogul, M-O-G-U-L dot club. You can also check out the website at www.mogul.club. You know, feel free to reach out to me over LinkedIn. Likewise, as Tomas said, I'm sure Chris will say, would love to connect with anyone, talk about opportunity, increase educational opportunities, and really appreciate everyone being on the show and having me on the show as well.
Fantastic.
Awesome. No, James, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. If anyone would like to get a hold of me, you know, you can follow me on socials at Chris Logan, REI, CHRISLOGANREI for Real Estate Investor. And if you'd like to learn more about, you know, coaching one-on-one with virtual wholesaling and how to wholesale houses from home anywhere in the country, make your first 20K in 90 days, you can go to virtualwholesalingmadesimple.com, apply for coaching, fill out the form. And if I like what you have to say, I'll consider bringing you on as a client.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. I'm your host, James Brown, and I show people how to make safe, secure returns through our unique time-tested hybrid investing model. What that is rent-to-own investing. So we're helping people become homeowners. Warms my heart. Go to hybridinvestor.vip to learn more and add the www if it doesn't pop up for you. Also, huge thanks to our producer, Antonio Holman, with United States Real Estate Investor. Follow and subscribe to This Month in Real Estate Investing on YouTube at youtube.com/@UnitedStatesREI or your favorite podcast app. It goes out to all of those. If you run across any interesting news, events, or a good guest, please suggest those by emailing Antonio at UnitedStatesRealEstateInvestor.com. And remember, when one door closes, another door opens to financial freedom. Thanks, guys.